Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You, a podcast and podcast show that brings you leadership lessons, knowledge, experience, and wisdom from thousands of successful individuals from around the world. I'm your host, Ashutosh Garg, and today I am privileged to welcome a very accomplished and tall tech leader from California, USA, Mr. Raj Yavatkar. Raj, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Raj is the Chief Technology Officer of Juniper Networks. He's a board member, an advisor to startups, and an angel investor. And he was earlier with Google and Intel. So Raj, before we talk about technology, tell me about your own journey that led you to become the CTO of Juniper Networks.
Yeah, my journey is not as impressive as yours, I must tell you. But I went to US to do my PhD in computer science. I have a specialization in networks at Purdue. I did that. After that, I did a brief detour in academia. And then landed up in Intel to Intel. See, I was working on internet before internet became very popular because internet really took off in 94 or so with Microsoft Windows releasing browser and so on. So Intel hired me that time as an expert to do internet technology development. From there, I moved to products, did work at Intel for a long time. Then I moved to VMware, which was one of the best enterprise software company. Then Google Cloud, I was doing network infrastructure. And that's where I got hired into Juniper because they were for a CTO. So it's sort of an unpredictable kind of a path. Yeah.
Fascinating. So let me going to ask a few questions relating to your journey and Juniper. What, in your view, are some of the key qualities every tech leader should have?
I think one of the things you need to have is humility or what I call imposter syndrome. Because you know, as you reach, go higher up and up in the hierarchy, you have to accept the fact that you don't know everything. You probably have a lot. So having that kind of humility or worry or almost paranoia to some extent about not knowing enough, relying on, is very important. Because other people to whom you draw knowledge as well as work, they are the ones who make you successful. The second part is constant learning. And technology changes every few years.
Right.
I had to work every 4 years, I had to switch to different adjacent technology path or learn completely new technology and so on. And the third one is really connection to individual engineers. If you want to be a technical leader, ultimately you have to go down in the organization and form connections with people. Forming connections also applies to outside in the industry and the ecosystem. Those connections are useful, important to constantly learn, get new feedback, get new visibility into insights into what's new is happening. So those are qualities I consider important for technology.
Very interesting. Yeah. Great response. And, you know, when I was reading about you, you have over 45 patents to your name. What is your approach to fostering innovation within your own teams?
Yeah, that's a work in progress because constantly you have to change the way you think about innovation and foster innovation. What I like to do is that encourage brainstorming sessions where people should feel to go to the whiteboard and try out ideas without criticizing any ideas. A lot of the ideas will not lead to anything. We also hold focus groups kind of things where we get to bring a bunch of junior people with senior people to see what ideas we could think about. And that's how you lead to innovative ideas which you can prototype and patent.
Fascinating. And how do you balance the drive for innovation with the need for security when it comes to network technologies?
That's one of the biggest challenges, especially nowadays with generative AI and so on. There are very unknown threat vectors. So one of the things we try to do is that have for each project associated with one security architect, whose job is to constantly find holes in your architecture and design right from the start, rather than waiting for penetration testing and other testing at the end of the product life cycle. So because when you do innovation, people want freedom. They want to move fast. While doing that, if they have a security architect whose job is not to meddle, but be a voice of reason to say that what we should be watching out for. That helps. And that, as I told you, it's a work in progress. We make mistakes and we keep on adjusting. This is the hardest area, balance security with innovation.
Very interesting. And you just talked about AI, for example. But, you know, When it comes to AI and machine learning, you know, being able to access virtually everything in the world and draw upon, and now you've got generative AI coming in with through ChatGPT, et cetera. What role do you see AI and machine learning playing in the evolution of network security?
So it's both positive and negative, right? Positive, first let's start with negative. The generative AI is now able to generate code in which it can create backdoors without your knowledge. Generative AI can be used to create new threat vectors, attack vectors that you did not even think about, right? So those are the negatives, challenges. But at the same time, generative AI can help with lots of things. For example, it can do automated SOC compliance. It can generate. It can create, for example, GenAI can be used to create automated penetration testing. And we're finding it does much better job than what we do. And finally, we can also use generative AI to predict the test vectors, attack vectors, and use those for testing. So there is sort of a constant race between good and bad, which is getting more difficult, in my opinion, with the machine learning and generative AI.
Fascinating. So the other question then is that, you know, when you talk about leading large teams, et cetera, what insights can you share from your experience of leading large teams to deliver cloud networking infrastructure?
Actually, that was one of my best experiences at Google Cloud because Google has really revolutionized the software development methodology with respect to, for example, there is no separate quality assurance team at Google. Everything is owned by a developer. So when I had to deliver these products, there were a number of lessons I learned. One lesson I learned is that you have to use a systematic approach. So for example, I'll give you a very concrete example. There are 13 weeks in a quarter. And developers are very bad at estimating output compared to, because they're always optimistic how much they can get done. So what I started doing is that 13 weeks I would divide into chunks. I would say you have only 8 weeks of work available, work time available, 1 week of vacation, 2 weeks to just pay technical debt or do unexpected things. So you add up those things to 13 weeks. You create enough capacity. So there's 1 week for experimentation or innovation also available. But it's indirectly built in because you didn't plan all the 13 weeks of capacity, engineering capacity, time capacity. That was one of the biggest lessons I had. The second one is that, you know, creating technical leadership in individual contributors. Individual contributors should not be just doing their own work. They should be assigned three, four junior engineers who they mentor and manage because that improves the work output because it creates a bigger footprint for them. They have a lot more resources. So they think of a team or a group, not just individual success. That's the second important thing I learned while developing those products.
Fascinating. And, you know, given all the work that you've done across multiple companies, for my viewers and listeners, can you talk about a particularly challenging project that you faced and how did you navigate it?
Yeah, that's one example I'll give you, right? If you remember that Windows used to have this famous blue screen, that suddenly your Windows will have a blue screen. And if you're in a corporate environment, especially your desktop or laptops were new that time, IT had to send somebody to your desktop to repair it because Windows could not reboot or the blue screen. People call it a death screen or blue screen. So we had this idea. I was talking to our IT people about how to improve that. And we thought, why not create a way to remotely diagnose and repair the machine if you could do that? And since a networking guy, I thought, if I could find a way in a completely machine which is dead, capture the packets coming in at the network interface card level, and if you have a small microcontroller to run some code, it could bring back the whole machine. That turned out to be a very good idea. Now we wanted to productize it. We call it active manageability technology. Intel later on branded it as Intel vPro. Every laptop used to have a sticker called Intel vPro. The challenges we ran into is that, you know, technology-wise, we're very good. We did not think of security to your point. And I still remember IBM was a big customer. And I went to present to them. And the first question they asked about it, how the system could be compromised, because now you're remotely controlling, remotely sending in network traffic, anybody could come in, bad actors could come in. And I had not thought about it. And they told us, we'll not buy this product. I come back and general manager was very upset. That was the biggest lesson I learned, you know, that you have to think of many different things. Of course, the fixing it, we went to Electronic Frontier Foundation and stuff like that. It was turned out a very successful product. And every laptop used to have, I was very proud of that. Intel VPro, I still see the branding and I remember how it came about. But it was a very important lesson that, you know, think of things that are not directly related to the technology, but in terms of delivering the whole solution, what are the features?
Fascinating. And you're right. I mean, that little sticker on every computer of Intel Inside, actually built huge amount of credibility for the brand of the computer itself. I think
That's
that
true.
was something amazing that you probably pioneered in the world of technology. Thank you. My next question for you, Raj, is that, and we'll talk a little bit more about networks. How do you envision the future of networking technology in the context of Internet of Things and smart devices?
So Internet of Things and smart devices, as everyone admits, is going to be billions of devices. Right? They're already online. At home, I have 47 devices, if I remember correctly, connected to a small devices, not the big devices. So Internet of Things is definitely there. So people are building edge clouds or some infrastructure closer to the IoT devices. And you have things like smart cities, smart airport. Those are happening. In India, I was just recently, India is building smart cities. So the future of that is going to be that the network is moving from centralized infrastructure to more decentralized distributed infrastructure. The local control, the decentralized control is becoming very important. And that's going to create, now with machine learning, you need to do inferencing for autonomous devices and so on. Those also happen at the edge of the cloud. So because of that, you have thousands of, tens of thousands of edge clouds. And this leads to more decentralized infrastructure environment.
Interesting. And how do you envision the future of intelligent self-driving networks?
Those are already happening. You will not believe it, but I tell you that we have actually, I just talked about Juniper Networks. We have products for Wi-Fi networks and campus branch switching and SD-WAN, which are completely managed using AI machine learning model. And we have customers like Walmart and UPS and ServiceNow. We have publicly admitted that 90% of their troubleshooting tickets are never served. They are self-resolved using machine learning. So this is the first step, big step towards creating self-driving, self-learning networks. Now the question, how do you extend that and apply it to large data centers, large transport networks, your mobile networks, and so on? That's going to happen. I mean, the next 5 years, you'll see a tremendous change. Pioneered by companies like us and other people who are working on it. It's no
That's it.
longer a vision, no longer a dream. It's how.
Well said. So, a few minutes back, we did speak about cloud. And I forgot to ask you one question, so I'll come back to it. How do you see the role of hybrid clouds evolving in the next few years?
Hybrid clouds are here to stay. I tell you why. Almost every enterprise has legacy applications, which are not going to move to cloud. They will stay in the on-prem data centers. All the new applications are moving to the cloud. They're not in one cloud. Some are in Oracle Cloud, some are in AWS, some are in Microsoft Azure because Office 365 is there, and Google is great at analytics data sciences. So now you have now this forest of applications, I call it, distributed in different clouds, different regions, on-prem, and that is the hybrid world, which is here today. I mean, if you're a small company, maybe you will not see it, but if you're a larger company, larger enterprise, even medium-sized enterprise are seeing that. So I think it's very clear that the world is always going to be hybrid. People think that everything goes to public cloud. I don't believe so. There will be a need for having hybrid cloud for other reasons also. For example, as we talked about smart devices and IoT devices, they require local processing. That processing cannot be done remotely. Same thing about autonomous driving and other things, which require inferencing at closer to where the processing is being done. So for that reason, the world will be hybrid now.
Fascinating. Next two questions are for you personally, Raj. You've been a leader for a long time, led teams across multiple organizations. How do you approach mentorship and leadership within your organization and with your team?
See, I'm very passionate about mentorship. I learned that long time back because I was fortunate to get a mentor. And I always like to tell people there's a difference between mentorship, coaching, and manager. Your manager is only interested in output from you and getting it as fast as possible. Coach is like a basketball coach. He sits at the side and orders, sends you commands, shouts at you. The mentor's job is very different. First of all, it comes out of empathy. Mentor's job is to put himself or herself into your shoes and create possibilities. Right. Ask questions. Have you considered this? Have you considered those? Rather than directing. And that allows a person to grow. So one of the things I have done is I started developing a class at Intel and then taught in VMware and then even at Juniper on mentorship, how to do mentorship. And part of that I focus on is career development. A lot of the people do not know how to do career development. Right. One of the things I have come up with is that it's like a software development process. Just like you write your requirements and then you write your code and then you test, career development should be like that. Set a goal, do analysis of your current abilities versus what you have to show to be performing at that level,
right.
gap analysis, and work towards that. So all these things go sort of combination of mentorship, career development, coaching. These are different aspects, but I like to emphasize all of those while working with people.
Very interesting. And can you share with us a memorable moment from your career that significantly impacted your professional journey?
Yes. So when I went to VMware, I remember that I did not have a well-defined role. And my manager, who later on became the CEO of VMware, he told me, "You're a new guy. We haven't figured out what to do with the cloud. Why don't you go and figure out what to do?" So I didn't know where to start because it's a completely blank sheet of paper. So I started talking to people and I ended up in a place, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Twin Cities, Minnesota, because there are lots of large enterprises there, 3M, Best Buy, Target, lots of them, Mayo Clinic. And I started asking them. And one of the things I still remember is that that sort of conversation led to an idea, germinated an idea about how to create automation so that you can stand up a private cloud, a hybrid cloud in less than a day. And that struck me as a sort of idea, and it's impossible. But that really turned out to be the best professional experience because I ended up building a product like that, like a startup within VMware. Yep. And that opportunity I would not have gotten if I had not gotten out of my comfort zone. Just try different things, try to talk to people out of complete ignorance. You know, you start asking people, what is your problem? What problem are you trying to solve? I never would have, because all my career, I always knew well-defined problem to solve or go after something well-defined. Here, it was completely nebulous. And from that to form something that ultimately delivers value turned out to be memorable experience.
Fascinating. So I have time for two more questions for you. My next question is that if you were to look into a crystal ball, my question is, what emerging technologies are you seeing that you are most excited about and why?
So I think that I'm most excited about two, three things, right? One is quantum computing.
Yeah.
It's still away 5 years, 10 years, but quantum crypto is developing much faster. And one of the things people are looking at it is that quantum key distribution to avoid the man in the middle attack. You can always start implementing now key distribution in quantum. Next step is quantum crypto, which is going to really change the way. And it's a threat, by the way, because you have a lot of data at rest encrypted and quantum algorithms could easily break it. So you have to come up with a sort of first quantum crypto algorithms and quantum computing itself. Now, IBM has built one of the largest quantum computer. It's not very large, but it's able to solve still some financial modeling problems and so on. So that's a very exciting area. Second one is, of course, you know, this whole generative AI, where it's going to lead to us to, we do not know yet. I was just reading a New York Times article where they talk about how they applied generative AI for modeling cells. And that in the 6 weeks of time, that model was able to find a cell called NOD cell, which is a very rare cell in the kidney that's important, which scientists, biologists have taken 120 years to find.
Wow.
That's the level of development we're talking about. So I think that level of development leading to, like we talked about, self-driving, self-learning, that's exciting but unknown thing. And it has ramifications, positive as well as negative, ethical concerns, bias. You know, 70% of the population this year is going to go to elections this around the world. They're likely to be manipulated by this kind of technology. So that danger is also there. So very hard to tell where we are going to go, but a pretty exciting time in my opinion.
Amazing, thank you. And my last question to you, Raj, and this is for the thousands of people who will, listen to our conversation and or view the conversation. You have achieved a lot of success, and you are right at the top of your career, and I'm sure there's more to go. What would you say are three lessons you would give to young engineers or young aspiring individuals to follow in your footsteps?
So number one is constant learning. As I said, every 3, 4 years, you have to be ready to move into an adjacent area from where you're comfortable with. Learn new technologies. Don't be afraid. The second, I think, the important area is really focusing on what I call stakeholder management. Learning who the stakeholders are around you and why they are needed for your success. Because no matter what development you do, what you do, it's important that you have to use other people, other stakeholders, manage them in the way that they contribute to your success. And the third one is extremely be focused on collaboration and teamwork. I mean, very few people succeed on their own. A lot of the success comes through serendipity. And serendipity happens because you work with others. They inject new ideas, new things you did not think about, did not see. So because of that, it's very important to do that.
Very interesting. And Raj, on that note, and your three amazing lessons, be a constant learner. I love the term adjacency. And I'm sure when you talk of adjacency, you're also probably talking of leapfrogging many generations because that's the way technology is growing. Second was so important, learn to manage your stakeholders because that is critical. And the third one, which is even more important, is focus on collaboration and teamwork. Thank you, Raj, for speaking to me about your own amazing journey. Thank you for talking to me about so many different aspects of networking, the cloud, AI, machine learning, and we touched very briefly on quantum, but I'm sure someday I will reach out to you and say, let's do a separate conversation on just quantum computing and its, allied technologies that could impact the world. Thank you again for speaking to me and good luck to you.
No, thank you. And it has been a privilege. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.